The 13th Candle by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 5. The gentle rain came drifting down as though wafted earthwards by a compassionate goddess of mercy, bringing renascent life to an arid area. The softly falling water, as tenuous as a mist, hesitated and wavered, as though uncertain of its destination. Then, touching the dry soil, there was a faint hiss, and the moisture vanished into the depths. In the soil, little rootlets stirred to a dim awareness at the liquid touch, stirred to awareness and avidly absorbed the life-giving water. As though by the waving of a miracle wand, the first tiny specks of green appeared on the surface of the land, a faint dusting of green which grew and thickened as the rain increased. Now the rain had increased to a torrential downpour. Huge drops fell and raised small gouts of earth, besmirching the newly green plants with sodden mud. Here and there the first tiny buds appeared. In this desolate region, nature was prepared to move fast, to put forth vegetation at the first sign of moisture. Small insects scurried busily from plant to plant and leaped from pebble to pebble. From a nearby depression in the ground there came a faint, strange hiss, followed by gurgling and the tinkle of rolling stones. Soon there came the first swelling waters of a rivulet, carrying a scum of unwetted soil, drowned insects, and the dry debris of an area a long time without water. The clouds lowered even more. The monsoon weather of India butted against the Himalayas and spilled torrents of water from upset, heavily laden clouds. Lightning flashed and the thunder roared and re-echoed against the mountain sides. Here and there lightning struck viciously against a towering pinnacle, shattering it, exploding it into a cloud of dust and stones which came tumbling down the steep mountain sides to thud heavily against the sodden earth below. A boulder toppled and fell with a soggy splash into a pool of water, crushing plants, spewing mud all over the rocks. The river, in full spate, overflowed its banks, and the tributaries found their flow reversed. The willows found the waters climbing higher up their trunks. Birds cowered forlornly in the topmost branches, too wet to fly and fearing the end of the world. The rain fell. The marshes became lakes. The lakes became inland seas. Thunder boomed and roared around the valleys with the endless, senseless echoes, a thousand times repeated, making a mind-stunning medley of sound. The day darkened and became as the dark of a moonless night. The rain fell as though in solid sheets. No longer was there a discernible river course. Now the whole land seemed covered with turbulent water. A howling gale sprang up and lashed the surface of the flood into white froth. The shriek of the wind rose higher and became a shrill keening which tore at the nerves and gave one's thoughts of souls in torment. There came a vivid flash, as though the sun were exploding, and a shattering crash of thunder, and the rain stopped as though upon the turning off of a tap. A shaft of sunlight pierced through the darkness, was momentarily obscured, and then the clouds were overcome and rolled back to let the light of day shine again upon the flooded world. dotted around on the higher ground where there was yet some semblance of firmness, dark gray masses of boulder-like proportions suddenly hove to sturdy feet and became monolithic yaks with sodden hair, streaming rivulets of water from broad backs. Lethargically, they shook themselves, sending sprays of water all around them. Satisfied that they were rid of all running water, they nuzzled the drier ground in the endless quest for food. Beneath the precarious shelter of a mighty rock outcrop came excited chattering. Gradually figures emerged, muttering imprecations against the inclement weather. Groaning, they stripped off their sodden clothing and wrung it dry and donned it again. Soon, from humans and animals, a faint haze of steam rose as they dried out in the increasing heat of the day. A young man detached himself from the group and went running across the land, skipping from dry patch to dry patch as best he could. At his heels, a huge mastiff barked and gambled. With shouts and barks, the pair set the yaks moving in the direction of the others, and then, that accomplished, man and mastiff set out to round up the ponies clustered against a distant rock wall. A rough path led the fallen rocks to a space which had been cleared at the foot of the mountain. From thence the path deviated and wound upwards for some 300 feet, terminating in a rock shelf upon which grew a straggly bush some 6 feet high. Beyond the bush, the rock face gave way to an opening, the entrance to a rather large cave, eventually leading to tunnels from a long extinct volcano. A speck of color, no, two specks of color, showed to the careful observer. At the mouth of the cave sat a llama and his acolyte, both dry and at ease, both looking out over the vast plain of Lhasa, observing the rapid runoff of the waters hitherto flooding the land. The unexpected cloudburst had left the air even clearer than usual, and the pair gazed out over the familiar landscape. From far away, the golden rooftops of the Potala shot out blinding gleams of light as the sun was reflected from the many facets and angles. The newly painted front of the building gleamed with ochre, and prayer flags whipped and weaved in the stiff breeze. The buildings of the medical school on Iron Mountain looked strangely fresh and clean, and the buildings of the village of Sho glittered brightly. The Serpent Temple and Lake were clearly to be seen, and the willows in the water were nodding their heads as if in some unspoken agreement. Faint dots of color showed that monks and lamas were going about their everyday business. A thin thread of pilgrims could be discerned, making their way along the inner road of the pilgrim circuit on their act of faith journey from the Cathedral of Lhasa to the Potala and back. The western gate was shining in the sunlight, and a straggle of traders could be seen passing between the Pargo Ke Ling and the small nunnery opposite. Below, at the foot of the mountain, the traders had succeeded in loading their yaks and mounting their ponies. Now, with many a shout and jest, they were making their slow way along to the pass leading down, down, into the lowlands of Tibet and China. Slowly, the lowing of the yaks, the barking of the dogs and the shouts of the humans, passed out of hearing, and peace and silence descended once again. The Lama and the acolyte surveyed the scene before them. In the distance, to the left of Shakpori, the ferryman could be seen in his inflated hide boat. Frantically, he stabbed downwards with his long pole, trying to reach river bottom and stop from being washed away on the swollen crest of the overflowing river. Desperately, he reached out and probed deeply down. His boat tipped beneath him, gave a sideways shimmy, and slid away, leaving the boatman struggling and drowning in the floodwaters. The boat sped on, lighter now, and borne by the swift waters and sped faster by the breeze. The long pole drifted idly in the shallows, which had, ironically, been so near, while the boatman floated face down after them. High overhead, the vultures swooped and wheeled in search of their food, staring with keen eyes towards any human or creature in distress. One tentatively dived on the drowned boatman and swerved away at the last moment, observing closely. Seeing no motion, the bird swooped again and landed on the dead man's back. Preening itself a moment, the bird looked around defiantly and then went to work on the back of the man's head. "Tomorrow," said the Lama to the acolyte, "we will travel down to the lower reaches and call upon our friends. For this day we will rest and relax, and it will be an opportunity for us to conserve our energies. The journey will be long and arduous. I see there are a few sticks washed by the base of those rocks." He rose to his feet and pointed. "So you go and collect them, and we will prepare tea and sampa." He smiled slightly and remarked, "And after that, I will give you some basic instruction in relaxation and in breathing, both matters in which you are notoriously deficient. For the nonce, go and collect the wood." He turned and entered the cave. The small acolyte scrambled to his feet and reached for a length of rope set to one side. Coiling it around his waist and over his shoulder, and so placing himself in grave jeopardy of hanging, he shuffled off down the path to the floor of the valley. About to round a large boulder, he checked himself suddenly. There was a large bird sitting and preening and drying out its feathers, besodden by the recent downpour. The small acolyte stopped and pondered upon his course of action. If he waited until the bird buried its head beneath a wing, he could steal forward and give it a bump on the behind, to its great amazement. But if he wriggled forward on his stomach, he could grab the bird by the foot. The first idea was obviously the best. He edged forward, holding his breath, inching forward until he was pressed flat against the side of the boulder. The bird scratched, preened its feathers, and flapped its wings, and then, satisfied that it could be no cleaner, it settled comfortably on the rock and buried its head beneath the wing. Entranced, the small boy hurried forward, stumbled over a fallen stone, and fell headlong. The bird, roused so suddenly by the fright, reacted as birds will. It ejected a noxious gift over the small acolyte's face and then lumbered heavily into the air. The small boy fumbled desperately at his eyes, which were suddenly glued shut. From the cave mouth there came a soft chuckle. At last, the acolyte clawed the sticky, smelly mass from his eyes and face and made for a small pool of water set in the hollow of the rocks. There, very reluctantly, he dipped his face in the ice-cold water and scrubbed himself fairly clean. From above came the exhortation, "Don't forget the wood!" The boy jumped. He had forgotten all about it. Turning, he made off down the rock-strewn path, but temptation was ever in lurk for small boys. On a great flat rock there swayed an immense boulder. By some freak of nature, it had fallen in such a position that it balanced exactly. And now it was teetering forwards and backwards. The young acolyte beamed and moved forward. Placing his hands against one surface, he pushed hard, relaxed as the rock swung backward, pushed hard again, and gradually built up a greater and greater swing. At last, the rock swung far beyond its center of gravity and toppled with an earth-shaking crash. The boy grinned with satisfaction and turned back towards the cave. Halfway there, he jumped with fright as he received a stern telepathic message which almost cracked his skull. "Wood," commanded the message. "Wood! Wood!" Turning on his heel, he went running down the path again with "Wood! Wood!" drumming through his mind. At last, a large amount of wood was gathered. The young acolyte bundled it together and then passed the end of the rope around the whole pile. The other end of the rope he put around his waist, and, dragging and straining, he managed to convey the whole bundle to the mouth of the cave. There the llama was waiting somewhat impatiently, and he helped break up the wood into suitable sticks for the fire, which was speedily kindled. "Your posture is deplorable," said the llama, "and we shall have to do something about it, or you'll end up like these Western people who I have seen when visiting India. Before we start our breathing exercises, let me instruct you on an exercise which is most applicable to the present occasion." He smiled as he told the young boy to rise to his feet. "This is an exercise which is wonderfully invigorating for those who sit a lot, and you are sitting most of the time," he said. "This exercise is very good for reducing abdominal fat. It has the interesting name of the wood chopping exercise because its action simulates the benefit to be obtained when chopping wood. Now stand up." He made sure the boy was standing erect. "Imagine you are chopping wood. Imagine you have a very heavy axe in your hand, one of those very, very good axes which have just been brought in by the traders from Darjeeling. Now stand firmly, stand very firmly, and have your feet wide apart. Then you must clasp your hands together just as if you were holding the shaft of a heavy axe. Imagine that the head of the axe is on the ground, so take a deep breath and raise your hands and the imaginary axe high above your head until your body has gone to the other extreme and no longer is bending forward, but is bending backwards. You have to bear in mind that you are lifting a very heavy axe, so let your muscles simulate that. You're lifting a very heavy axe. Then with this heavy axe high above your head, hold your breath a moment. Then, vigorously, breathe through the mouth and swing down with the imaginary axe in a very strong motion, as if you were cutting a very big tree trunk. You will not, of course, come to a stop with the impact of the wood and the axe, so instead, let your arms swing right down between your legs. Let your arms swing down so that your hands are in a line with your feet. You must keep your arms straight, and you must keep your spine straight. You should repeat this exercise several times. Now go to it, my boy, and do it with vigor, with at least as much vigor as you used to topple that rock. The young boy went through the exercise until at last he stood panting and grunting with the effort. "Oh, holy llama," he said breathlessly, "surely exercises like this could kill a person, unless they were in good health. I feel almost faint myself." "My dear boy," said the llama in some exasperation, "an exercise like this can do only good, except in the case of a person who has a weak heart, or except for women who have some feminine ailment. I doubt if your heart is at all defective, but from the way in which you grunt and groan, you might as well be an old woman, and so you will have outgrown the female disorders to which I refer. So try your exercises again." The young boy slumped down, sitting hunched up on the ground, fingering his feet. The llama, who had been standing on the edge of the rock wall, looking out across the valley of Lhasa, turned suddenly and said, "Why are you so hunched up? Are you ill? Are you suffering pain?" The young acolyte looked blank for a moment and then replied, "Ill? Who? Me? Ill?" The llama snorted and went towards the boy, replying, "Yes, ill, you. You're sitting there like an old crony, suffering from bunions or corns. You're sitting there like an old crony by the side of the marketplace, listening to the gossiping of the traders. Are your feet troubling you?" He dropped to his knees and looked at the boy's feet, and then, satisfied that there was nothing wrong, he rose to his feet again. "Boy, on your feet," he commanded. "Here is how to relax your feet. I suppose you got them tired by frightening that poor bird, and then by upsetting the rock, which was certainly not causing you any harm. So now you have tired feet. I will show you how they may be relaxed." He took the boy by the shoulders and saw that he was standing upright. "Now," he said, "this will give you better circulation of blood. You must stand on one foot. Stand on your left foot first. Then lift your right foot off the ground and shake it from the ankle down. Not the whole of the leg. Remember, we're just dealing with your feet. Shake it. Keep your leg still and violently shake your foot from the ankle down. Shake it for about 3 minutes until it begins to tingle. Then put that foot back on the ground and raise the other leg and shake that foot for 3 minutes. Do this 3 times. It will help you when you have cold feet. It will help you after you've had a long march or when you've been standing too long. It will help you when you have been toppling, teetering rocks." He smiled for a moment and then he said, "Always do these exercises barefooted. Never wear your sandals when doing exercises. There is much benefit to be gained by having one's feet actually in contact with the ground." The poor boy groaned and exclaimed, Oh, holy llama, I feel much more tired now standing up like this, and doing all these exercises has caused my body to ache with tiredness. Can I not rest a while? The llama gave a secret smile and said, You really step into little traps, do you not? You've got yourself tired by doing the things which you should not do, so if I show you the things which you should do, you can avoid getting tired when doing the things you should not do. So, let us remove the tiredness from the upper part of your body by the very elementary exercise which our Chinese friends call relaxing the trunk. But holy llama, said the young acolyte in some dismay, I thought we were going to do breathing exercises, not this awful stuff. The llama shook his head reprovingly and said, Boy, these exercises are just the prelude to breathing exercises. Now pay great attention to me, because this particular exercise would better be known as a series of four exercises. It is designed to help your neck, then your shoulders, the center of your back, and finally the whole of your body from where your legs join your body to where your head joins your neck. First, you will stand like this. He bent down and pushed the boy's feet apart about 24 inches. Always stand with your feet slightly apart and let your head drop forward as if you have lost the power of the muscles. With your head drooping loosely, let it slowly circle clockwise just once. Your arms will be hanging loose. After this, you will let your head hang lifelessly forward again. But this time, you will let your shoulders droop as if you have no muscles. Your head is hanging loose, your shoulders are drooping, and your arms are hanging loosely as well. Then, let your shoulders make a clockwise movement, but the head and the arms will remain limp, without moving. After you've done this, do it anti-clockwise. The poor, wretched boy, looking a picture of woebegone misery, went through the exercises. By the time he had finished, he did indeed feel lifeless. But the llama soon snapped him to attention, saying, Now, drop your chest forward. Let the whole of the top part of your body make this circular movement. You have to rotate the whole of the top of your body, everything above the waist. After you've done it in one direction, do it in the opposite direction. The boy stood there with his feet slightly apart and looking so limp that he appeared in danger of falling over on his face. First, his head and shoulders rotated in one direction, then slowly in the other. Now, said the llama, you will have to put your feet slightly farther apart so that you have a very firm stance. Then you make everything above the waist absolutely limp, and then, bending from the waist, you make a wide circle, as wide as you can possibly manage without falling over. You make a wide circle clockwise so that you're in some danger of being overbalanced. Continue making these circles, getting smaller and smaller circles until for a moment you are motionless. Then start moving again in the opposite direction, making the circles larger and larger until once again you're in danger of overbalancing. And then when you have done that, do it once more. And after that, let just your shoulders rotate and counter-rotate. When you have done that once, let your head rotate and counter-rotate. Now, he said, do you not truthfully feel a lot better? The young acolyte looked cautiously at the Lama and said, Holy Lama, yes, I must admit, I do feel a lot better for that, but I am sure that I would feel even better if I could have a rest, because, as you said, we have a long and hard journey before us tomorrow, and I fear that these exercises might tire me unduly. The Lama laughed and said, Well, on this occasion we will do no more, but throughout our journey down into the lowlands, you will have to learn other exercises. You will have to learn about breathing, for our journeys are more than just covering land. We have to cover knowledge as well. The more you learn now, the less you have to learn later, until you get to the point of knowing that the more you know, the more there is to know. But be off with you for now. So the young acolyte suddenly recovered all his energy and sped down the path in search of any adventure which might present itself. The Lama resumed his seat at the edge of the cliff and remained gazing out across the beloved valley of Lhasa, where even now the sun was beginning to set and the lengthening shadows crept across the rock-encompassed land. The shadows turned deeper purple and sped ever faster across the dark floor of the valley. The western wall of the mountain range already was black, with here and there a vague pinpoint of light showing as the faintest of flickers. Light shot in golden shards across from the Patala, home of the inmost one. Behind Iron Mountain, the Happy River glinted as a lighter path in a dark abyss. But swiftly the sun withdrew behind the mountains, and the dark of night seemed to rise up as the waters rise up in times of flood. The eastern wall of the mountain sank deeper and deeper into the approaching night. Soon there was nothing but the purple night, with the gentle breeze wafting, even to this distance, a suspicion of incense and rancid butter. Thousands of feet above the topmost ranges caught a last glimpse of the sun. A golden line, like a flaming banner, ran along the topmost edge, lingering longer at the highest points, until even they were extinguished in the universal darkness. Time wore on. The people of the night set about their business. A night bird called, and at long last was answered from afar. A lonely mouse squeaked, followed by a scuffle, and a shriek abruptly ended. The night wore on. The stars shone forth in all their hard brilliance in the cold, clear air. Bright in the colors never seen from lower lands, they seemed to wink and twinkle as though engaged in some mysterious business far beyond the ken of mortals. Slowly a ghostly silver radiance misted the far horizon, and majestically there lofted into view the gibbous moon, with mountains and craters plain for even the unaided eye to see. Softly the luminescence spilled over into the valley, shining on frost-whitened peaks, sending brilliant showers of incandescence from the Patala rooftops. The Happy River turned to molten silver, and the waters of the Willow Lake became as a perfect mirror. The moonlight grew, casting in stark relief the shadow of the Lama sitting motionless by the bush at the edge of the cliff. A probing finger of light wandered into the mouth of the cave to reveal the prone body of the young acolyte, sleeping the sleep enjoyed only by small boys. From a great distance came the rushing rumble of a sudden rockfall, followed after an interval by the crumpling thud as mighty boulders struck the earth after tens of thousands of years in one spot. Came, too, the frightened squawking of some bird which suddenly found cause for alarm in the earth's shake. The night wore on. Majestically, the moon sailed across the sky and withdrew demurely behind the sheltering mountain range. Timidly, the stars faded in the approaching light of a new day. The sky became suffused with color. Bands of light raced from horizon to horizon, growing ever brighter. Nightbirds croaked sleepily and sought their daytime haunts in secure crevices in the mountainside. The creatures of the night prepared to sleep through another day. The night wind slowed. For an appreciable space of time, there was dead calm. Then a slight breeze sprang up in the opposite direction, and the creatures of the day bestirred themselves. The small acolyte sat up suddenly, rubbed his eyes, and rushed outside. A fresh day had begun. It was a simple matter to break the fast of the night. Breakfast, lunch, tea, dinner, call the meals what you will, but among the priests of Tibet, they were all the same, tea and sampa. The roughest, crudest tea of all, made specially into bricks from China. And sampa, well, there was no other food. These foods, tea and sampa, provide all that is necessary for the maintenance of health and life. Breakfast was soon over. The Lama turned to the acolyte and said, "And what is our next task?" The acolyte looked hopefully down the sides of his nose and said, "Should we not have a rest, Honorable Lama? I know where there is a vulture's nest with eggs in. Shall we watch them?" The Lama sighed and replied, "No, we have to think about those who will come after us. We must clean the cave. We must see that it is strewn with fresh sand. We must see that it is well stocked with wood, for the next travelers here may be in dire need of fire and of warmth. We have to remember we should have welcomed wood, so let us do what we would have welcomed." The boy went out and moved again down the steeply inclined path, kicking idly at stones as he jogged along, until he kicked at one stone which was not loose, but which was embedded deep in the earth. For some minutes he hopped around on one leg, uttering strange cries and holding the injured foot between his two hands. But something attracted his attention. A feather came fluttering down from the sky. In the excitement of seeing this large vulture's feather, he forgot all about his foot and chased after the falling fragment. It was just a dirty old thing blown along by the wind, so he threw it away and continued his interrupted journey in search of wood. At last the cave was swept clean with dry sticks, and the inner wall was stacked with wood, ready for the next traveler. Then, sitting together on the edge of the rock, the Lama said, "You will have to learn about breathing. Your breath is noisy, like the creaking of a vulture's wings in a breeze. Now, how are you going to sit for your breathing exercises?" The young acolyte immediately jerked to attention and quickly sat in a most exaggerated lotus position. He put his palms up in his lap, and on his face appeared an absolutely wooden, frozen expression, while he did some peculiar thing with his eyes, as if he was trying to gaze at some imaginary spot a few inches above and in front of him. The llama laughed outright and said, "No, no, you do not sit like that at all. Breathing is a natural thing. You sit or you stand in any way convenient and comfortable. Many people suffer from a form of dementia when they think of breathing exercises. They think they have to adopt the most extraordinary and unnatural poses. They think that breathing cannot be beneficial unless it is also a considerable hardship. My boy," he said, "sit or stand in any way comfortable for you. You can sit straight up, but you must, and this is the only important matter, you must keep your spine as erect as is comfortably possible. The easiest way is to imagine that your spine is a post stuck in the ground and the rest of you is just draped loosely around it. Keep your spine straight then. You will not be tired." The llama was already sitting erect with his hands clasped in his lap. He looked at the young acolyte, saying, "Relax, relax, you must relax. You are not undergoing torture. You are not being a model for one of our butter figures. You're learning to breathe. Just relax. Let yourself sit naturally with your spine erect." He nodded his approval as the boy sat in an easier manner, and then he said, "Oh, that's better. That's much better. Now, you must breathe in slowly. Let the air fill the lower part of your lungs, just as the darkness of the approaching night first fills the lower part of our valley. Then let the air rise to the middle and the upper part of your lungs. You can actually feel it, but do it without a jerk." He paused and smiled and then continued, "When the shadows of the night herald the passing of the day, first the shadows creep across the ground, then the darkness rises constantly, smoothly, evenly, without change of speed, without jerk, and so it is that you must breathe. As the shadows rise up and the darkness fills our valley at night, so must the air within you rise up and fill your lungs. But as the air enters your lungs, force out your ribs. Pretend that the day is hot and your robes are sticking to you. Pull out your robes from your sides. Well, make your ribs come out like that, and you will find that you can take in more and more air." He watched to see that the boy was following his instructions exactly, and then, satisfied that this was so, he continued, "You can feel your heart thumping, so in this first case, let the air flow within you for 4 good heartbeats. You will find that your body expands during the in-breathing period, and it shrinks when you breathe out. You should exaggerate slightly the natural expansion and contraction." The llama suddenly spoke sharply, "No, no, boy. Definitely no, you must keep your mouth shut while you are doing this breathing. Are you trying to catch a fly or something?" The boy shut his mouth with an audible snap, and the llama continued. The whole purpose of this exercise is to draw air in through your nostrils and to circulate in the air spaces of your body, and then you breathe out again through your nostrils. When I want you to breathe through your mouth, then I will tell you so. But first of all, until you are more proficient at this, you must practice for about 15 minutes, rising later to about 30 minutes. The boy sat and breathed, and the llama gently raised a hand to serve as an indicator of the correct rate of breathing for the young acolyte. At last he said, "Well, that is enough for now. We must set about our business." He rose to his feet and dusted the grains of sand from his robe. The boy rose to his feet and copied the llama's action. Together they looked in the cave to make sure that nothing had been forgotten. Together they went down the path to the floor of the valley. At the bottom, the llama arranged certain stones to show the way to the cave above. Then turning to the boy, he said, "Go and collect the ponies." Gloomily, the acolyte moved away, looking for any sign of the small horses. At last, climbing on a big rock, he saw them about a quarter of a mile distant. Carefully, he maneuvered from rock to rock until he was within feet of the horses. The horses looked at each other, and then they looked at the young acolyte. As he walked towards them, they walked away at exactly the same speed. The boy changed direction and tried to run ahead. The two horses imperturbably moved a little faster and maintained the exact distance. By now, the boy was getting rather hot and was panting. The horses, the boy was sure of this, each had a cynical sneer on their face. At last the young acolyte had had enough. He went back to where the llama was still standing. "Oh, honorable llama," he said in some frustrated irritation, "these horses will not let me catch them. They're making fun of me." The llama looked at the poor boy, and an amused smile hovered at the corners of his mouth. "Is that so?" he inquired mildly. "Then let us see if they'll come for me." He moved into the open and clapped his hands together. The two ponies had resumed their grazing, but they raised their heads with ears very erect. The llama clapped his hands again and called for the horses to come. They looked at each other and then looked back at the llama. They looked at each other again, and both began to trot towards the llama. He moved to them and patted them and put his own pack on the back of the larger of the two. The smaller pony looked at the small acolyte and moved away as the boy approached. At last, the boy was running to catch the horse, and the horse was just moving in a circle. The llama, tiring of the sport, spoke sharply to the pony, which immediately stopped and became docile. The boy moved forward, being very, very careful to stay clear of the hoof end, and placed his bundle on the horse's neck. The llama nodded and mounted the horse and sat quiet. The boy took a fantastically big leap to catch the horse unawares, but the horse moved slightly, and the boy sailed straight over its back to land with a crash in the sand. The llama moved forward with a sigh of resignation, saying, Oh dear, oh dear, our daily entertainment. But we are in a hurry. He leaned down, picked up the small boy, and dumped him unceremoniously on the back of the small pony. Come along, he commanded. We've wasted enough time. We have to move on, or we shall have lost another day. Together, the horses stepped out across the earth floor, avoiding rocks. The llama was slightly in the lead. The boy strove to keep up behind. He never was proficient at horse riding, and he never would be, but he did his best. On they rode, the llama sitting comfortably erect, untired, untroubled. The boy on the smaller pony was sagging like a sack of barley, but unlike the sack of barley, the boy was getting sorer by the minute. At last, after some 3 or 4 hours of travel, the llama stopped and said, "We will rest here for a while. You may dismount." The small acolyte simply ceased to cling to the horse's mane and slid to the ground in an undignified heap. The horse moved sideways several feet. End of chapter 5.